Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening. Who are tuned in, we give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. We began the UAC after the unjust Zimmerman verdict of July 2013, and are celebrating our fifth year on the air here with you. So we ask that you continue to support us and our sponsors, Manhood Raising Culture, headed up by my co-host tonight, Dr. James Jones. You can find Dr. Jones on Facebook as James Jones, as well as a liking group page for Manhood Raising Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraisedculture.com. also support Arlie Gordon of Unity Design. Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. You can find Brother Arlie on Facebook as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And last but not least, we want to always remember our beloved brothers and sisters who are behind enemy lines and the families and loved ones and friends that they represent. So please reach out to Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement, respectively, on Facebook and on the World Wide Web at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. So tonight I'm going to go ahead and open up the mics and get tonight's dialogue started with Dr. James Jones. Greetings, Dr. Jones. How you doing this evening?
I'm great, Queen. I'm great. How you doing?
I'm good. Hanging in here, rolling with the punches. You know how we do.
Yeah, well, we got to do it. Chuck D said, I roll with the punches so I survive. So we got to follow Chuck's leadership. It ain't going to always be easy or comfortable for us, but that's what's up for us.
Ashe, how are things going in your neck of the woods?
You know, we started classes this week, and, you know, it's for me, I love teaching. I love my kids. You know, I'm an educator. And that's just what it is. So this has been, in many ways, a very glorious week for me. You know, and I'm sitting in my office right now doing the show because I dealt with students all day and I hate traffic. So I had to make the strategic decision of, you know, would I try and drive and do the show or would I just go ahead and mash and stay in the office and get some things done. So it looks like I'll probably be in my office for the next 4 hours because I do your show and then I'll do also Brother Maurice's show. And so I'll leave here at 9 and then I'll be back in my office at 5 a.m. Working again.
Ashe. Well, we shall appreciate you. You know, I know the students.
I appreciate y'all.
Yeah, we, you know, we have often had discussions on the importance of living it, how we talk it. And, you know, that's one of the main things that I do respect about you. You know, you're not just somebody that's out here just talking. You know, you could probably be touring just like, you know, a lot of other folks are doing, talking, but you actually put in the work, you know, behind the things that you say. So, you know, that's to be appreciated and respected at all times.
You know, I appreciate that, but it, you know, it's a thing for me. I hate being away from home. I'm a homebody, and you know, I've done the lecturing around things and what have you, and yeah, I've been, you know, I am who I am, and I'm not a people person. You know, I'd rather write, you know, be off somewhere reading, and it's, you know, it's also a very that type of thing is very stressful for me, you know, meeting and greeting people and shaking their hands and then, you know, and trying to make eye contact with them and make them feel warranted. And then, you know, I start sweating, I get nervous. I feel like I'm about to have a stroke or something before it's all said and done. So at the end of it, you know, it's just not my fit. And then, you know, one of the things I often deal with my students is that they don't understand that this theatrical, energetic individual that they engage standing in front of them in a classroom, that's not who I am. That's a role that I play. And frequently, you know, people who will see me, they'll meet me, their initial time meeting me is me lecturing or on a panel discussion or even doing a radio interview. And they expect to meet that person when they meet me. And most people are shocked when they come across the fact that I rarely talk away from lecturing or anything like that. I'm like the most subdued, quiet, you know, shy person that people would ever come across. And it rubs some people the wrong way because they're like, oh, man, you know, I thought he was standoffish. And it's not that at all. It's just quite simply that. You know, even with my homeboys, when we're hanging out, I rarely talk. You know, I'm the quiet one out of the group. You know, I'm the quiet one in a big black family that all, you know, heck, they talk. You know, and I often tell people this about my upbringing, that one of my grandmothers, and I was blessed to have three grandmothers. My paternal grandfather was married twice, and one of my this was his second wife. she talked to my mom about me, and she said, "Can he talk?" And my mother was like, "Yeah, he can talk." She said, "He won't even say when he's hungry." And she said, "Yeah, yeah." And in many ways, my son is kind of the same way. You know, he's very laid back and subdued. And if you're not used to it, you'll take it as being sullen, disrespectful, what have you. And that's actually one of the things, if there's anything, it's one thing that I've had to really get on him about. I'm like, "Yo, you got to talk to people a little more," you know, because I know the errors and the missed opportunities that I had. And many people are telling me, "Yo, you're missing opportunities now because you don't talk to people." I'm old now. So I got to, you know, I'm turning that bend towards being that ornery guy. So I'm good. So this is the most socializing that I do, believe it or not, the entire week.
Ashe. Well, yesterday, before we get to hot topics, I want to bring up something with you real quick, to get your input on it. Yesterday, I played A-Track Brown, Imam Jamil Alameen speaking, and
I tried to get here, but they had me teaching. I teach a Tuesday Thursday class at 5, and it ends at about 6:20. So I got to my office about 6:40, and the show was off. And I was like, "Oh man, I'd have missed rap."
Yeah, it was good. It was really good. And I'll post the actual videos as well. But he talked about the importance of practicing ideology over personality. And to hear him say that, it just resonated in a way that I wanted to bring forth some discussion around, you know, the concepts and the importance of that very thing, and get you to give a definition, if you will, even from a historic perspective on ideology itself as a definition, and what are the things that the original party did from that perspective that even to this day, you know, we have to still respect them for, and we should be still even utilizing, if you will, in what we're doing and trying to build.
Okay, so what do you want to start? What is ideology?
Yes, the definition of ideology.
Okay, I'm getting old, so let me handle the first one by itself, and then we'll move on to the next one. when we're talking about ideology, especially when we're talking about a political organization, we're in many ways talking about their manifesto, which is what it is that they believe and what it is that they do and what is this path that they're going to take in regards to achieving those goals. And to be absolutely honest with you, the original Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the one that was headed by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, Eldridge Cleaver, the gang, that organization ideologically is undoubtedly the most misunderstood organization that we have. And the thing that makes the misunderstanding surrounding the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense so voluminous and reverberating is quite simply the idea that people are seeking to pattern themselves after the Panthers. And I liken it to taking a trip. If you're taking a trip from Cincinnati to Cleveland, Ohio, and you don't know the route, really, you kind of know that it's north. But if you jump out there and you say, "Well, look, we know it's north, so let's go up 75 north." Well, you're traveling north, but from your very first step, your very first decision, you're in error. And so in many ways, that's what we're talking about when we talk about, number one, the misunderstanding of who Huey P. Newton was and what his vision was and the multi-layered goal structure that Newton had in regards to the Black Panther Party. So to just circle all the way back, when we're talking about what is ideology, it is your set of principles. It is what you are striving for. It is your strategy. It is your goal structure. And in many ways, it is how you're going to operate and maintain that program. And I yield with that, Queen.
Ashe, thank you for that. And that's very helpful because we want to be clear in and why this is important. And so thank you for that. And now let's take it to looking at the fact that, one, we know that ideologically there were several things laid out in the platform of the original party that made sense, still makes sense to this day. However, it got led off track by a lot of outside influences and people, just like they're doing now with this new party, as they call themselves, defining themselves by the gun. And that's one of the things that Minister Alamit said last night in the speech, is that, you know, that does not define vanguard revolutionaries. We're not defined solely by the gun. So looking at it from that perspective and knowing what you just said to be true, what are the things from an ideological perspective that you are known of from a historical perspective that to be facts that they use that we still should be using and paying attention to this day, especially those of us who do call ourselves or consider ourselves or the community consider us to be part of the vanguard? And I yield with that.
Can you unpack that a little by little? I mean, this is kind of different for me because I'm literally in my office sitting in front of my computer, and I'm writing out the questions that you have to make sure I cover them. So give me a portion of that right away, just a little snippet.
Okay,
the first part you'd like for
me to
do.
Knowing the things that were happening in society that were the catalyst to the ideological basis for creating the Panthers from the beginning, not what they turned into, not what COINTELPRO turned them into, not what outside influences turned them into, not the fools that, you know, define themselves by the gun, as I just stated, turned them into the basic ideological approach to why the Panthers were formulated, what things existed there that you know of that we should still be paying attention to this day, especially considering that we are building.
Okay. Number one, dealing with the idea of what are the catalysts behind the Panther Party. It's a multi-pronged catalyst. You know, if you go back to the mid-60s, and we have to remember that the Black Panther Party was formed on October 15, 1966, in the North Oakland Poverty Center. We have to look at what was happening in that moment. And the things that were happening in that moment as far as a historical context, framing the Panthers, you got to remember that, number one, Malcolm is killed in 63. By 64, we have what many people thought was the jab that was going to set up the knockout blow for what people erroneously refer to as racism in America, which is really white bigotry that they were dealing with. And that comes when Lyndon Baines Johnson is going to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It's going to, of course, be followed by that heavier punch, which is the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And many people celebrated and thought that racism had, if not been knocked out, it at least was stunned and would be subdued very quickly. But the problem with that is that within 2 weeks of the Voting Rights Act, and we have to remember, and I don't want to gloss over the idea that the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act are the two measures that actually brought black folk into equal status on the law books of America. Okay, now that's not in regards to the exercise of equality, but they're most certainly equal by 65 in the eyes of the law. So we have that going on, but 10 days later, you know, you have the Watts Rebellion, really putting a damper upon all the euphoria that was surrounding the idea that we had made a significant blow against racism. So you have to put as the historical context behind what's going on in the world of Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. We also have in 1965, James Meredith is going to be shot as he's trying to do his March Against Fear down the highway that connects. He's from Jackson. He was trying to walk from Memphis, Tennessee, to Jackson to tell his people, his black folk, that they should no longer be afraid of white folk. And, of course, Meredith gets shot on the first day of the march. It's during the continuation of that march that Willie Mukasa Ricks is going to get up in Greenwood, Mississippi. He's, of course, a SNCC worker, and he's going to change the entire trajectory of the slogans that are motivating the movement. And he comes up with the idea of black power. What do you want, black power? When do you want it now? And it's in direct contradiction to what we previously had, which is what do you want freedom, you know, when do you want it now? And you have to remember that at that moment also, and this is just sort of a sidebar, the movement was still interracial. So by 1965, we see a shift. We see identity politics rising up. We see black folk, young black folk, adhering to what Malcolm was saying about your agenda needs to be focused upon aiding black folk. That's what leads to the environment with Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. And you have to remember that Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale were kind of community organizers before. And so they're looking at what their community wants and what they need. And so when it comes time to forge this organization that these two individuals are going to be heading, Huey, who is a genius, he's a theoretical genius, you know, and it's Huey that, to be honest with you, that the new versions of the Black Panther Party never deal with, okay? But Huey is advancing this very sophisticated two-tiered idea of membership, which is quite simply the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense should incorporate those who are in possession of bourgeoisie skills, meaning college students who can write, who can organize, and what have you. But also he's going to utilize what we refer to as the lumpen proletariat, the brothers on the block. Now, there's going to be shortcomings with dealing with both of them, those groups, but we can talk about that later. But more importantly for what we're talking about right now as far as the initial structure, Huey P. Newton had an understanding that the liberation of the black nation would be predicated upon two stages. The first stage was a survival stage. Huey felt that we needed to get our people to the point where they were actually stable enough, that they're no longer scrounging around trying to make ends meet. And he felt that if you could get them there to that point where they could recognize that it's not the Black Panther Party that is going to save them, they're going to save themselves, that they finally understand that they have everything they need to execute a revolution. And then the second stage of that is actually the revolutionary stage. And one of the things that these, I call them pseudo-revolutionaries, fail to really understand when they're talking about the enormous legacy, the weighty ideology and theoretician that Huey P. Newton actually is, they don't want to accept the fact that Huey puts it this way: the revolutionary is a doomed man. And what he's talking about is quite simply that old catchphrase of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. What Huey's saying is that the revolutionary that fails, he's going to die on the battlefield. The revolutionary that leads a successful revolution is no longer relevant because the people are now free. He's no longer needed. So those are the things that are infringing and impinging upon what Huey in particular is thinking. You know, you have the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. You're going to have Watts. You're going to have Willie Ricks in Greenwood, Mississippi. You had Malcolm's death and his overarching influence. And then you had this black community that Huey has been organizing in already. And he's hearing what these people want. And what they want are those very mundane and, we could argue, very conservative demands that are found in the 10-point platform and program. There's nothing revolutionary about what they're asking for. They're asking for basic decency and human rights. And I yield with that, Queen.
Ashe, yeah, I mean, all things considered, one, the similarities are almost haunting to where we are now and where we were then, to the point that it almost brings forth a visceral effect. You know, it's a damn shame. But two, I think it was quite revolutionary because it showed that the power is truly still with the people. And to me, that's exactly, you know, again, where we are now is bearing witness to the fact that there is still power in the people, and there must be power in the people. Otherwise, you know, the society is going to continue to deteriorate. And one of the things that Brother Son Benu Hannibal of the Free Alabama Movement, I saw him post, is that, you know, he said, united we stand, divided we continue to stand, you know, instead of divided we fall. And so it's those kinds of, I guess, isms, if you will, that we've conditioned ourselves to subconsciously or consciously, overtly or covertly, that we must overcome. So I do think it was a revolutionary act for them to take their power back in the way that they felt like they needed to first, and in a way that, you know, showed that, again, that truly the power is with the people. And I know that there's strength in that, to bring that forth in a way that is bold. It's empowering to bring kinds of actions in a way that are bold, and because I've seen them work, and they're working now.
Yeah, I think that what Huey would say to that is quite simply that revolution is a process. It's not a destination. It's a process. And this is also the man, and this is one of my favorite quotes of Huey. He says that, you know, when you have these low moments and you don't think that you're making any difference in the world, he asked his party members to always remember that to move one grain of sand is to change the world. And so you have that process that's going on. And you can, I guess you can term, you know, that process of igniting a fire within the people as being a part of the revolutionary process, which I believe that it is. But I think that so often that when we begin to banter about these ideas of what revolution actually is, that we begin to make some connections that are personal connections that are not necessarily agreed upon. For instance, Fred Hampton, the great Panther leader, you know, young brother out of Chicago. Fred Hampton was known to issue this saying, and it's a saying that Jesse Jackson stole from Fred Hampton. He just said it a little differently during his presidential campaign. But Fred Hampton would say black power to black people, brown power to brown people, red power to red people, yellow power to yellow people, white power to white people, all power to the people. And a part of the angst that I always have when I come across these quote-unquote black nationalist types is quite simply that they're dooming themselves to a fiery death by cordoning off themselves from humongous swaths of potential revolutionaries that are in other communities. And one of the often not discussed aspects of the Black Panther Party for self-defense is quite simply the overarching question of, are the Panthers even black? Because if you look at their ideology, you look at who they're around, especially after they defected from the black community and the black church, the Panthers are surrounded by white folk and some yellow folk. So until we really begin to look at the Panthers in a very real way, and by real I mean we're able to divorce ourselves from this silly ideology, which is advancing that the Panthers are carrying these guns and they're trying to intimidate white folk and they're trying to, you know. Well, the original name of the party was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. They're not going out and being aggressive towards anybody, okay? But until we understand, and this is really how ridiculous for me, as somebody I wrote my doctoral dissertation in my first book on the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It's treasonous. It's a blatant, you know, a copyright infringement for you to operate in the name of the Black Panther Party. And you haven't, number one, studied their history. But you also don't understand that if the party is created on October 15th, 1966, and the Panthers raid the state capitol in Sacramento on May 2nd, 1967, and shortly after that, that document, that law that we call the Panther Bill, which is really the Mulford Bill, has been it. What it did was it removed the right of citizens to carry weapons inside of city limits. It's directly aimed at the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Yet at the same time, it allowed white hunters to carry their guns and to hunt outside of city limits. So I say that to say this, such a small portion of the Panther existence involved guns, especially when you're talking about the Oakland Panthers. Huey, if he was nothing else, Huey was steadfast. He was doggone near OCD in regards to his party remaining inside of the legal confines of the law. You know, we have to remember that when the Panthers first started their Panther patrols, and Huey and Bobby and little Bobby Hutton would get out the car to observe an arrest from a legal distance, they also had law books with them. So they're trying to fit a revolutionary process within a draconian legal system. Having said all that, it's disingenuous. It's a trademark infringement. It's wrong to sit up and to equate the Panther existence as being so gun heavy. You know, I read something today. Elbert Big Man Howard, one of the original eight Panthers, died. And they had a ceremony for him, and Kathleen Cleaver got up to speak about the big man. And Kathleen Cleaver or Erica Huggins, it was one of those two. And while she's getting up to say her remarks about her fallen comrade, someone shouts out, "He was a soldier." And she stops her commentary, and she says, "No, he wasn't. He was a writer. He was a thinker. He was a beautiful person." And it's in this rush to substantiate or assert a manhood that we have created this falsity about what a Panther was. Everyone wasn't Papa Rage. Everybody wasn't Eldridge.
Mm-hmm.
You had people like, who's the brother? Who's the brother that did the Panther? And I can't believe I interviewed him for my book. Emory Douglas. He's an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Huey is a shy dude who gets nervous just like I get nervous when I got to speak in front of crowds. You know, but when you go along that path, and once again, going back to the analogy of leaving Cincinnati and trying to go to Cleveland, but you're going up I-75 instead of I-71, you take this wrong step, and then you combine that wrong step with another one and another one and another one and another. Your foundation is flawed.
Ashe. And there's lessons to be learned in that.
Without a doubt. There are lessons to be learned, but the question becomes, how do you learn? You got to go back and you got to study the foundation. You need to pull out a map, and you need to look at what were the influences to these guys and what were they trying to achieve. You know,
yeah.
Huey
and we know one of the things one of the things that their foundation was built on is studying. So you're absolutely right. I mean, and that is one of the ideological things that, you know, I was referring to. It was required to know a certain amount of history and to do your homework, if you will. But hold tight, brother Brother Eugene's on the line. I want to bring him in. And then I yield back to you to finish your point. Welcome, Brother Eugene. Hang out with us for a second. I just wanted to open you up.
Kiki, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hey guys. Good afternoon. And I just caught the tail end of the conversation. And from what I've heard, there was a misconception about what the actual Black Panthers was about. I echo those sentiments because what they try to do, what people try to do, well, the vision of history, they don't understand, the, like you said, the foundation. And like you said, Queen, it was all about study. And that's when my mom, she was a part of that faction, and she built that into us as kids. You always have to study, she said. And that one thing that always sat with me when my mom was that she said that, she's always saying, you know how to keep stuff from a Black person? That's what people used to say about it. And I'm like, what? She said, keep it in the book because we don't study. And so that was a lot of things with me. And that's why, you know, as far as my brothers and sisters, we need to get back to studying. And the misconception about them is that they were just vigilantes and people who just were unruly and, like you said, gun-toting and all that. No, it was people who studied. They had their own lanes, and, you know, they were very intelligent, and the strategies they implied and implicated and tried to implode on, you know, as far as executing, they were very, very shy, but they all had their particular roles. You had nurturers as far as the women. They didn't really want the women from what my mom, my mom served in that, I think, in the outer skirts of that. But she said they didn't really want the woman from what she, when she was involved, having a prominent role, but they was accepting of that. But, I mean, just to re-echo what he was stating, that absolutely they all have their roles, and they were not just all running around gun-toting. So that's very, very, very blasphemous if that's what people were thinking. I'll leave you with that.
Welcome, brother.
Let me
say welcome to you, my brother. The thing is that when you look at the socialization that goes into building a revolutionary, to building someone who is trying to pick up a revolutionary mantle, they've got to be immersed in the same things that those that they are aspiring to be like. You got to be immersed in that same material, because that material is going to illuminate and make your vision more expansive. What is it that Huey P. Newton experienced or saw that caused him to use kind words with his people? You know, anyone who studied Huey would understand that Huey had a bad experience with some cats who were collegians, and he felt that they talked to him, that they degraded him and talked to him in a negative manner. And Huey said, that made me set down and not want to be a revolutionary. So going forward, when he gets his own program, he vowed never to do that. So he tells people, take your time and explain it to the people. But within this present context, it's a situation where how many of these pseudo-Panthers have read Mao Zedong? How many of them have engaged Frantz Fanon? How many of them understand that Huey P. Newton, although he admired what Robert Williams did, he had significant issues with Robert Williams? How many of them can comprehend that it's the Peace and Freedom Party, a bunch of white, radical white boys who gave much support to the Panther cause, especially when Huey was on trial for fighting for his life? The same Peace and Freedom Party, they ran Eldridge Cleaver as their presidential candidate. So you're talking about the need to study, the need to open your eyes and your mind, and to understand that the problem that black folk are dealing with in America is multi-pronged. It's a multi-fold, multi-stage problem. And what Huey eventually came to understand, what Bobby came to understand, what Fred Hampton beautifully articulated, is that your first problem is not racism. That's one of the problems, but that ain't your primary problem. Your primary problem is class. It is a class struggle. But as long as you see a white boy who ain't got as much as you got as the same as one of Donald Trump's children, you'll never see the potential for an alliance there. And that's in many ways what needs to happen. We need to sort of blow up everything that we think that we know about the revolutionary process and start again. Take nothing for granted. You know, we're at a point where we need to shut things down for about 5 years and just go study and build within each other to get a grasp of what it is that we're really facing. Because this is about money. This is about, you know, you wonder why black folk died as soon as, because they're the poorest. You wonder why there are droves and droves of white folk on public assistance and welfare, because they won't divorce from being white before they look at their own economic interest and come all over here and join forces with us. So this problem when you're dealing with the Panthers is multi-pronged, and it has to be studied. It has to be analyzed. I went on a 60-day stretch where every night I read some of Huey P. Newton's writings. And reading it as a 48-year-old man who's lived some life and made some observation, it affected me in a way that it had never affected me before. And I yield right there, Queen.
Ashe, I yield back to you, Brother Eugene.
Well, I mean, I couldn't say it any better. If you look at some of the programs that they were implementing, like he said, it was classism, and then obviously the exact underline was after that education, obviously racism, all those things that would be right up under that. But if you look at some of what they were doing, providing breakfast programs, providing some of those services, they understood that it was a classism thing. That I remember when I was younger, my mom used to always say that this is strategic. Like it's strategic that you have lower class income minorities and some whites in certain areas because, you know, they understood that, you know, if you keep them impoverished, if you keep them in those specific areas, they're in some cases, well, most cases, they're never going to make it out because they'll kill themselves off. And so that, you know, that it makes sense, you know, and that's why it was always about classes. Because economically, if I make more money, obviously I'm going to want to do better. Occasionally, I'm going to want to have better housing. Obviously, you have a better job, so now I can obviously start purchasing things and do better for myself. But if you're always going to be poor, you're never in most instances, you're always going to be at the bottom. And, you know, you look. She used to always talk about that, and I never understood that until I got older because we were always in a poor state and, you know, as far as being from Gary, Indiana. And so I saw that as I got older. I'm like, wow, like, you know, from across the tracks, you could just see the different classism of blacks. You see the people who bought more about the link, they had better jobs, better housing. We all went to the same school, but you just seen it in a day-to-day basis as far as the students. And you saw it in our education. And so it basically reinforced that classism was their point of emphasis and why they were started. And so I echo those sentiments and I deal with that.
Ashe. I want to remind the listeners that if you're listening on your phone, you can push 1 and join in the conversation. If you're listening on your computer, you can dial in at 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059. So just to analyze some of the things that you said, Dr. Jones and Brother Eugene, is that you're absolutely right. And to this day, Dr. Jones, even when organizing here in Cincinnati, there's a group that's organizing under the banner of Black Liberation. But again, when attending their meeting, it's a room full of white folks, but white folks are who show up. We have a tendency to come along just when things are, I guess, at an exciting point or, you know, something has happened to us on a personal level, and then we fall off. So being accountable for that is one of the things that I know that we need to work on. On the other hand, in organizing the Black property owners here, one of the challenges that we face is being able to use what is known as a public space in order to gather. And the director of the recreation department, where, you know, we've been using the recreation center for the past few months, we know that it's, you know, supposed to be open to the public. We're not asking for it to be open beyond business hours per se. But they were getting ready to try to charge us $35 an hour to continue to use the recreation center when, again, one, we're there during normal business hours, and two, it's technically a public space. So we've had to go through a struggle with the director of the Cincinnati Recreation Department in just being able to have a safe place to meet in order to strategize around some of the things that the Black community needs to do. And he told me just yesterday that if this is some sort of specialized group, that it might continue to be a challenge and that we would have to submit a new request every month. But if it's something that's inclusive of the general community, then it's something that, you know, they could probably leave open and available to us. So, you know, it is kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. But if we don't, who will? And if not us, then who? And with that, I yield.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the writing is on the wall. And the writing, you know what, it ain't even written on the wall. It's been etched into the wall that we have to approach this thing through a two-pronged position. And it goes back to what Huey was talking about, that first stage being a survival stage that is aimed at getting our people to the point where they are able to realize that they are who they've been waiting to come and save them. That's a realization and an opening of the mind. And what, you know, and one other thing that I'll say about this, and I'll stop after this, is that one of the problems that the Panthers had was, quite simply, that they were one of the few Black Power era organizations that were willing to publicly have relationships with white organizations. And groups like us, they criticized the Panthers and used that as one of the great dodges to go ahead and say, well, look at them. You know, they over there in bed with white folk and X, Y, and Z. And Huey's response to that was very simply, what level of disbelief and poor self-esteem must you have to believe that every time you see a Black organization in an alliance with a white organization, that the white organization is controlling them? If they're going the same direction that we're going, let's work together. However, the moment that we need to veer left and they decide they want to keep going straight, we sever that relationship. And the fact that so many quote-unquote pseudo-revolutionaries are so afraid to engage whites in a relationship that can be mutually beneficial, at least for a period of time, is revealing. Because in many ways you're saying that any relationship with them they control. No. You get your organization together, you get your priorities together, your goal structure, and what you plan on doing. And if you can work to advance that with them, great. However, what we tend to do, and we saw this with many of the women's marches that we've seen recently in D.C., is that we arrive without a developed platform and program. We join their organization. Well, if you join their organization, well, you're agreeing, you're signing a contract, literally, to follow what their priorities are. So don't be surprised when you don't appear on their priority list. So develop your own and work your own. And in many ways, this is one of the things that for me is elementary. I realized this a long time ago. It doesn't matter what those opposing forces are doing. If you're out here focused and running 100%, you're going to get to see their playbook. And once they reveal their playbook, if there's a commissioner that is working against your interests, guess what? Get him out of there. Spend your energy sitting around arguing about, oh, well, you know what they did and blah. That's not productive. We recognize what it is, and then we go ahead and we take definitive, concrete actions to bring about the world that we want to see our children live in. And I yield with that.
Ashe, Brother Eugene.
Touched on something real profound there, and I like to expound on that. So I deal with a lot of relationships where I work at, and a lot of, I work with a lot of good white folk. And so one of my coworkers, he was providing an initiative for Chicago Public School System and how to allocate certain resources. And so one of the brothers was upset and told me to the side, like, why do they always try to control things? And my response to him was simply this. I said, if we came together, I said, obviously, you got to understand this is their organization. It's founded by white people, so you got to understand you're in the belly of the beast, right? But I'm like, back to what you were saying as far as leadership and coming together, if we come together and we all got the same general cause, right? But if blacks support it more and more and more, you kind of force their hand because that's what they do. Like you were saying, that they control any, that self-awareness, that introspective about them, that they, control everything. But, if you come to the party collectively and strong, you're going to force their hand. And so it was an issue over how to allocate funds. And so I said, just have a conversation with them. I said, because in the end, it's affecting our kids. Who can speak to the truth for our kids? Only we can. And so when we got in the room, we had a conversation. And he, I said, I said, well, coming from a person who was in these environments, because a lot of people who work with me have not come from these environments, right? And so I said, coming from a person who lived and grew up in these environments, that is not the proper way and the proper channel we should do this. And here's why. And, you have a lot of experts in the room, and they are needed. You understand that. But you actually got some prominent Kid American leadership in the room who can actually speak intelligently and articulate. You don't have to be articulate. I'm just putting it out there. But instead of being emotional about it, be able to speak to the truth about everything. That's not a good way of allocating these funds, and this is why it should be allocated this way, and speak to those opportunities for those. And what happened was the climate of the room changed, and they thought about, like, well, you think that makes a lot of sense, because you would know, because you live that truth. You understand the challenges that they, they're going through. And so, after the meeting or whatever, he looked at me and I said, we have to understand, like, it's 2018 now. So all that, the emotion, all that stuff, they're just not going to, they're going to tune you out. I said, especially in their organization. But if we're servicing our youth within that organization, and it's like 85% African-American in our organization. So you're going to have to force their hand if you come together. It's 85% of our own. It was strength in numbers. It makes sense, right? We have the right people to talk in front of them and say, hey, no, it should go that way. And so just reinforcing what you said about being because a lot of times, like you said, we'll, and I do that sometimes too. I'm like, I don't want to be associated with them because they're going to kind of try to control it. But if it's more than enough of us in that same capacity to make them understand and, like you say, push the common goal, I mean, they're going to use us like we use them, right? It's a relationship. And like you said, when you steer, if we steer left and they steer straight forward, you're separate. So it kind of makes sense. So, and I yield that.
You know, one of the things that just constantly gets me is that idea that we're not on equal footing, that really in every way you don't have the ability to go ahead and advance your agenda. And until you, because that for me is actually a psychological problem that some black folk need to get over. The fact that they are behaving as if they're dealing with their superior. And from my perspective, there's nothing further from the truth, you know. But until people really get to the point where they're approaching it with the understanding that this is a man or a woman, just like I'm a man or a woman, and anything that they're able to accomplish, I'm able to accomplish as well. But the actions, the cowardice, the skirting around of issues that we see so frequently within our community, it communicates a much different orientation and perspective that, just to be honest with you, it's one that I don't believe that anybody in their right mind could respect. And that's just what it is. And until people really get to the point where they're standing on their own too, not only physically but also psychologically, this thing isn't going anywhere. You know, it's almost as if we have a self-esteem problem and we're looking for like-minded individuals to soothe us in regards to our struggles. And, I mean, I guess that's fine for some people, but the truth of the matter is that you're never going to push forward. It's never going to happen. And I yield with that.
Ashe, yeah, and that's why these kinds of conversations that, you know, we're all in different parts of these, you know, so-called United, and exposing the cancer is a part of the process. You know, we just, all of us affirm that it's not going to, as they say, happen overnight, that it has taken a certain amount of time in this condition, and it's going to take a certain amount of time for us to get out, but we can't just not get out. You know, we can't not take advantage of every opportunity that we get to speak truth to each other and speak truth to power. So yeah, you know, we, as Dr. Joy DeGruy says, we can't say if you just put a little bit of makeup on it, it's going to, you know, be okay. No, it's time to pull the Band-Aid off, you know, continue to expose conditions that cause us to be in the condition and the state that we're in as a community, and push past it, you know, through it, over it, or around it, you know, which, whatever, and by whatever means necessary, we will get through. And so I'm glad to be a part of this process, you know, to grow and develop in that way. So again, if you're listening on your phone, you can push 1 to come into the conversation. If you're listening on your computer, you can dial in at 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059. We are at the top of the hour, so let's take a quick break. And you're listening to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by New Power Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Something for my godson Eliza and a little girl named Corinne. Say the blacker the better, the sweeter the juice. I say the darker the flesh and the deeper the roots. I give a holler to my sister's own welfare. Tupac can, if don't nobody else care. And I know they like to beat you down a lot. And when you come around the block, brothers clown a lot. But please don't cry, dry your eyes, never let up. Forgive but don't forget, girl, keep your head up.
And when he tells you you ain't nothing, don't believe him. And if you can't learn to love you, you should leave him. Cause sister, you don't need him. And I ain't trying to gash up, I just call him how I see. You know what makes me unhappy? When brothers make mates and leave a young mother to be a cat. And since we all came from a woman, got our name from a woman, and I came from a woman. I wonder why we take from our women, why we rape our women, do we hate our women? I think it's time to kill for our women, time to heal our women, be real to our women. And if we don't, we'll have a race of babies that will hate the ladies that make the babies. And since a man can't make one, he has no right to tell a woman when and where to create one. So will the real men get up? I know you're fed up, lady, but keep your head up. I remember Marvin Gaye used to sing to me. He had me feeling like black was the thing to be. And suddenly the ghetto didn't seem so tough. And though we had it rough, we always had enough. I hopped up off about my curfew and broke the roof. Went with the local crew and had a smoke or two. I realized mama really paid the price. She nearly gave her life to raise me right. And all I had to give her was my life dream. Of how about the life and make it to the right screen. I'm trying to make a dollar out of. My body lost his whole family. It's gonna take the man in me to conquer this fantasy.
No, no, no.
It seems the rain will never let up. I try to keep my head up and still keep from getting wetter. You know it's funny when it rains, it pours. They got money for wars, but can't feed the poor. Said it ain't no hope for the youth, and the truth is it ain't no hope for the future. And then they wonder why we crazy. I blame my mother for turning my brother into a black baby. We ain't meant to survive, cause it's a setup.
Blog Talk Radio Wednesday night with my co-host Dr. James Jones. Welcome back, Dr. Jones. You might be muted, Dr. Jones.
You know, it takes me, you know, I'm old. It takes me a while to get back now. But I'm here.
Ashe, I want to remind the listeners, if you're listening on your phone, please push 1 and I will open up your mic to come into the conversation. If you're listening on your computer, 917-889-8059, 917-889-8059. We've got two callers in queue. I'm going to go ahead and open back up Brother Eugene, and we've got a new caller in queue. I'm going to open them up first, if y'all don't mind. Last 4 digits, 8028. Welcome to Sign of the Times. Who are we speaking with?
Alan Yang.
Greetings, Brother Alan. Welcome.
How you doing? How's everybody tonight?
Okay. Well,
good,
thank
brother.
You.
We're good. Great to hear your voice.
Same here, same here.
So that's
are y'all
that's
waiting on me to y'all waiting on me to jump
yeah.
in?
Yeah, well yeah, just, right. how about you recap
hey, no,
what
I've
we
been,
talked
I've
about so
the,
far tonight?
Who, Dr. Jones
yeah.
or me?
Yeah, Dr. Jones real quick and then we can and then I
yeah.
yield to the brother.
I've been on from the beginning. I've been here for on from the beginning.
Ashe, why well, yield? I all yield. Right.
Okay, well, I'll
okay,
go ahead and speak. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, we started off dealing with the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and I'm not sure if you have any more questions you want to issue, Queen, in regards to that, or if you want to move on to the next topic of dealing with what the fallout from Jordan Edwards case really means for Black America. I leave that choice up to you. Which way would you like to go? Because if you have additional questions, we can keep going down the Panther Trail.
No, I actually
would
like to yield to Brother Allen.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. The thing that I heard that I think that I didn't hear mentioned, you know, of course, you and Brother Eugene both did, you know, a great job of articulating the point. But one of the things that I was thinking about when I was listening to the conversation in regards to the Panthers is as long as I thought of the quote that states, or I'm paraphrasing, as long as the hunter can write, the lion would never be able to tell his history or something of that nature. And I say that to say that when you think about the Panthers being, you know, 40, 50 years removed from the actual happening of the original Panthers, we don't control the narrative anymore. And a lot of the times when we don't control the narrative, the ideal of what the Panthers were or what they represented can easily be twisted. I remember watching the movie Who Was Dragged by the Ku Klux Klansmen by the chain for, you know, over 500 or 600 yards or however long it was, and eventually the brother was decapitated. But I remember watching the movie, and they used the actual events when Dr. Khalid Muhammad, who was over the Panthers, when he came into Jasper, Texas. But the movie did a great job of trying to paint him as and the Panthers as the opposite end of the spectrum of the Ku Klux Klan. And as Dr. Jones talked about when he mentioned that either Erica Huggins or Angela Davis spoke about, you know, Big Man, we got to realize that is the total opposite. It's not the total opposite of what they were attempting to do. The Ku Klux Klan was a hate organization. Panthers was a freedom organization that loved all people. And that's why they always made the point, all power to all people. They attempted to empower all people. We could talk about, you know, their work with Leonard Peltier and, you know, a lot of the American Indian movement, the AIM, American Indian movement. Just a lot of the things that the Panthers represented was centered around ideology as well as love. And when we don't control the narrative, we start to see that it's painted a different way than their actual intention. Also, I'm not sure if you all got a chance to check out Black Klansman, which was a great movie. I really truly enjoyed it. But Spike Lee and Brother Jordan Peele did a great job of allowing the rhetoric of what they were attempting to say and do speak opposed to imagery. You know, I think Brother Stokely Carmichael was exhibited early, and then they used Harry Belafonte later in the movie to, you know, push the rhetoric or the ideology of what was being stated or what was the aims of the Panthers. And I think that that's where we often lose sight of what the Panthers really truly were. When I, you know, became engulfed in the Panthers, as I like to say, I was in college, so I was used to reading and understanding not only what the Panthers' ideology came from, and I know that was the question we started with the ideology, but what was the theologians that put out the information that allowed them to shape their mind frame? And, of course, Frantz Fanon and Mahatma Gandhi and others are, you know, Malcolm X were the backbone of what they stood for. So to to the point of the ideology, I think that there needs to be a reemergence of the works that shape the Panthers and their thinking and their overall aim. And with that, I yield.
Yeah, you know the idea, you know, of other people hijacking the Panthers story. I definitely get that, but unfortunately for us, it seems so common now that it's us misreading that story or not studying that story, because you know, with the proliferation of all the materials that we have available, it's inexcusable that you don't know. You know, and one really has to, you know, approach it from a position of you don't know because you don't care to know. You know, I have a colleague who approached me about book sales, and he says, you know, brother, how do you sell these books? You know, and I said, well, you know, I take one book and I try to, on a daily basis, put it in somebody's hand and get some money out of their hand. And he looked at me, you know, and I said, you got to study how to market your stuff a little bit better. You know, and he's like, I said, the only reason that you don't know how to do that is because you don't really care to do it. Let's be honest about it. And he just looked at me and said, ouch. You know, so in many ways, when I look at these fallacious presentations of the Black Panther Party, you know, call it something else. If you're not going to, you know, operate out of the truest sense of the party. You know, I disagree with Khaled Abdul-Muhammad's assertion that quite simply the Panther image belongs to the people. You know, I hear you, but there's so many other, you know, icons and images that one could use and could try and carry forward. You know, but it is troubling and disconcerting to the soul, to be honest with you, to see individuals who, let's be honest, they're rejects from usually the Nation of Islam. They couldn't hang it there, so many of them resurface, you know, as something else that they believe will allow them to act in a immoral way and yet keep their revolutionary edge going, and I yield with that.
I agree.
Okay.
We may have lost brother.
Okay.
So, Dr. Jones, I yield to you if you want to go ahead and move into the next topic.
Okay. One of the things that we've kind of pledged ourselves to doing on Wednesday is dealing with some of the current events and. You know, outside of that president that you both elected, you know, we have some other current events that I think that we need to deal with, and one of them is the verdict that just came down for the killing of 15-year-old Jordan Edwards. I looked at that occurrence and gave some thought to it and really came up with this piece that is aimed at, you know, kind of thinking about what our reaction is to these moments that many people are celebrating at because a white rogue law enforcement officer has been convicted, as he should have been, of killing a black child. So the piece appears on my site, manhoodraceculture.com, and it's titled, No Cause for Celebration, Why Black America Needs to Understand That the Issuing of a Guilty Verdict in the Jordan Edwards Case is Not the Same as Justice. And it reads as follows. Of course, I know that you're not supposed to live in fear. Fear is an emotion that tends to paralyze those that it wraps its unforgiving tentacles around in a host of ways. Yet I live a portion of my life gripped by significant fear. Now, I do not want you to misunderstand what I am saying. This fear that I allude to does not deal with my personal safety. Instead, the safety of my sons and all young black folk. The recent trial and conviction of former, and I quote, law enforcement officer, end quote, Roy Oliver, for the murder of Jordan Edwards stokes those fires. I'm confident that you remember this case of unnecessary lethal violence against a black teenager who happened to be leading a party in a vehicle that the disgraced officer decided to fire his rifle into several times. At least one of those salvos struck 15-year-old Jordan Edwards in the head. Therein lies the reason that I live in fear. I realize that my sons, similar to droves of other young black males, will commit the following offenses that will be judged by some angry law enforcement officer as grounds for him to serve as judge, jury, and executioner in a matter of seconds. Let us be clear regarding Jordan Edwards' responsibility in his horrific demise. He was black. He was male. He had the nerve to leave the safe confines of his home. He was socializing with his peers. He was riding in a car leaving a party. He failed to duck when Officer Roy Oliver indiscriminately unloaded numerous shots into the vehicle he was traveling in. It is the reality that the young black males and females that I teach on a daily basis commit these same infractions on a regular basis that leads to my fear. If the above infractions are worthy of execution, my soul cries for this latest generation of black America, as it is nothing other than luck that determines if they will make it home on any particular day. Making matters worse, black America sits in a familiar position of being either incapable or unwilling to protect its most vital asset, its young people. Although I doubted that anything could increase my rage regarding this pitiful matter, the post-verdict celebratory tone of Jordan Edwards' family and friends has done just that. The conviction and pending incarceration of this psychotic law enforcement officer is not synonymous with the presence of justice. Justice would be if God placed Roy Oliver in the grave that Jordan Edwards would no longer have any use for after God breathed life into his lifeless body. In matters such as this one, celebration and congratulations should never be considered a suitable replacement for rage, fury, and an unquenchable desire for revenge in the name of the deceased. Failure to possess such measures leads me to question, if you love this young man, I mean, really loved him, because he is gone forever. And as I am sure that you understand, he will not be the last to succumb to such senseless violence at the hands of morally depraved persons. And for that, we should all be ashamed. And that's the piece right there, Queen.
To Brother Allen.
Oh, no, that's a beautifully written, brother. Very beautifully written. I think that, I don't know, it's just a real tough issue. It's a real, real tough issue for me. And I say that in the sense of, you know, I too am an educator. I too have that same fear. I too attempt to, you know, get young people to see on a much smaller level than, but I think a much more direct level because of the school-age kids that I work with, you know, being 6 through 12 on a regular basis. You know, trying to get them to see that there is nothing that you can do that can prevent this. You know what I mean? So attempting to do what's right and or what they tell you is right or following directions on a very simple level can hopefully enhance your chances. But as you said, you know, you are at the mercy of a morally depraved person a lot of times when you deal with police who, you know, abuse their badge and abuse their power because outside of this case, there hasn't been many or any situations in which, you know, cops have been convicted of murder for the actions that they have, that they've done. So a part of me does want to say that, okay, maybe we're starting to see a little bit of a change and hopefully that this sets a precedent. So I do, you know, feel that part of it.
However, I totally agree with there's still not a reason for us to celebrate because this brother is, you know, this young brother is still gone. You know, this family still has to grieve with what happened. Of course, with him being convicted, I'm pretty sure that there's going to be some type of monetary compensation, but nothing brings back the life and nothing brings back the possibilities. I, too, am a father. I too, am a mentor of young men. So, you know, hopefully that this is the case that, you know, that can be argued to set precedent and, you know, it moves forward with other cases. But I'm with you. I mean, it's really not a time to celebrate because there isn't much to celebrate when one of us is gone and, you know, who's to know what his sentence is going to be? You know, what if it's 20 years? You know, what if it's 30 years? If the brother still is gone and he's able to fall free one day, the cop that killed him, it still isn't, you know, a solace. It's still not enough to replace the life. So with that, I yield.
You know, there's often a – go ahead, Quinn.
No, go ahead.
You know, there's often a you know, an expectation of justice, and you hear that word being bannered about, you know, on many occasions of offenses for African Americans, and rarely is justice even one of the options to be chosen. You know, we have our homes seized illegally. We have, you know, we lose jobs for no discernible reason. And what is the cost, you know, to the soul? What is, you know, how do you deal with that? You know, that damage that can't necessarily be calculated as far as dollars and cents. You know, I recently spoke with a colleague who's going through some very traumatic things at his job. Okay. And he told me, he said, "Bruh, you know, I go home, I turn all the lights out, and I cry every night." What's the justice for those who are torturing this brother? What's the justice for the officer who killed Jordan Edwards? And the truth of the matter is quite simply, you can't reverse it. And it's only in reversing it to the point where none of the harm, hurt, or damage that flowed from it occurred that you're going to be able to reset the clock and therefore find some semblance of justice and be able to dole out some appropriate punishment. You know, we have to really begin to pay very close attention to what it is that we're expecting when we deal with other populations and especially with the legal system. You know, because they're doing us in, not only leading up to the trial, during the trial, and during the incarceration period, that they're almost able to dole out whatever it is, whatever punishment they want to dole out, and then beat the hell out of us while we're serving that sentence. And I yield with that.
Yeah, actually, I just wanted to contribute real quick that, one, you know, I didn't feel anything. I felt numb. I didn't feel victorious, and I didn't feel hurt. And the only reason why to even think about it was listening to what you read to think about, like, you know, what did I feel? I didn't feel anything. I felt quite numb to it because, one, I've had that elated, I guess, hopeful feeling that things would change. You know, for quite some time, even going back to when my cousin was killed as a child by a Cincinnati police officer. You know, I had a cousin killed when I was about 6 years old. So that was my first experience with this type of violence. And two, I just wonder if they would have even convicted him if it had not been for the fact that his partner testified that what he said was a lie, that he was, you know, never threatened, if you will, by being run over by the car, because that's one of the first things that he said after he had shot into the car the way he did is, oh, he was getting ready to run you over, you know, but his partner testified that just wasn't true. So had he not testified, I wonder if the conviction even would have happened. So, you know, I've given up hope that they're going to all of a sudden wake up with this sense of consciousness that we matter. It's going to take for the people to take their power back and as we said, you know, earlier tonight, to control this narrative. Otherwise, we're going to continue to be victimized and targeted in this way, and with that I yield.
You know, the truth of the matter is, and I think that you bring a very valid point up, is quite simply that when we go into those courts, there is no, you know, guarantee of a guilty verdict, you know, and there's a host of reasons for it. And ultimately, at the end, and this is sort of the, I call it the OJ moment for me. So frequently it seems as if whites who root for their side as if they're rooting for a sports team instead of being able to get beyond that and rest their loyalties inside of truth and righteousness. After seeing so many of these moments where our people are denied, you know, justice or any type of, you know, amelioration for what they've been through, it creates a rawness inside of you. And I remember when I was in graduate school, I was at Ohio State, I was pursuing a degree in educational policy and leadership when the OJ verdict came down. And I remember going down with the rest of my classmates, and it's 95% white females. They're trying to get this administration degree so they can get the heck out of the classroom. And we watched it come down. And when they said not guilty, I was the tallest one in the group because I'm dealing with these women. So I'm standing behind them. And I don't know if it was a subconscious move. I don't know if it was conscious. But I lifted my fist up in the Black Power stance. And those white women were in tears instantaneously. And so we went back to the classroom and we discussed what that meant and what as educators you should do. And one of them, of course, you know, chose to attack me. You know, I can't believe that you're celebrating and blah, blah, blah. You know, all the evidence points to that he did it. I said, yo, I believe he did it too. I said, I believe he killed those people. I said, but it's a satisfying feeling to see you finally on the short end of the stick, being able to taste the injustice that we taste on a daily basis. And so having said that, I mean, I'm kind of numb to it, you know, and I criticize black folk for celebrating a guilty verdict because that's not justice. You know, your evaluation criterion has been skewed to a point that it's probably irredeemable. So, you know, I'm happy he's going to jail, but it's definitely not justice, and I yield.
Brother Allen, do you have anything that you would like to contribute? And can you announce where people can find your book as well before we close out?
All right. Yeah, I do. I don't know if I came off as if I was celebrating, because I'm not so much as celebrating as I like for it to be. I'm happy that there's a precedent, and I didn't know the details of the case, but Queen, you just made it real relevant because you said that the other officer basically crossed the blue line. And I think that that's why we don't see a lot of what goes on in terms of these murders or, you know, beatings or just up injustice on behalf of the cops towards blacks, whites, Asians, whoever. It's because they feel they never cross that blue line. You know, it's a blue line of secrecy where they never speak up. So to hear that in this case, this brother or whoever it was, the partner, you know, crossed the blue line and told the truth, that's enlightening and that's encouraging to me, because usually that's what allows so many of them to escape in instances when it's, you know, police involved, because they make the lie and they stick to it.
So I'll say that. That's one part. The other part that I was encouraged about was that if there is a precedent by the judicial system to, you know, to convict this brother, then hopefully we'll have the lawyers that can point to this case and the details of this case and use that to argue whatever it was that they these lawyers successfully argued to get that conviction. Because a lot of the times I think the lawyers don't have a precedent, so it's real hard to be that first. But now that we have a precedent, I think, you know, a lot of lawyers can use this as something they can point to win those convictions. So to that, I say that was to clear up what I was stating. I'm not old enough to have had an intellectual conversation that was, you know, centered around the, you know, the OJ verdict. I remember my dad watching it every day religiously, and I remember my dad's reaction and him explaining his reaction. And but I was, you know, I grew up in Gary, Indiana, 99% black at the time. And the idea and the mentality in my frame, I didn't really understand racism on a larger magnitude because of my age. So I say that to say, now that I get it, so to speak, I do understand that we need, you know, moments such as these, and I also understand why both of you all are numb and don't have, you know, the emotions. But I don't feel like, personally, the things are going to change or get better. You know what I mean? I'm never going to be of that mentality. Is going to be a case-by-case basis, and we are going to be, as Dr. Jones stated earlier, we're who we're waiting on. To the same point of what Dr. Jones alluded to, that Huey P. said, the revolutionary conundrum. You know, we're going to free the people, and then he's no longer going to be needed. So that's the ideal and mentality that I come from as well. We got to free as many of us from the mental liberation of not understanding what we have in front of us and going and riding the wave of these internet or pseudo-revolutionaries and say, I'm going to just attach myself to it. I say all that to say that, you know, I think that the hope and the possibility lies in what we're doing here. One, the platform that you created, Queen, the intellectual conversation, and us as intellectuals being able to touch as many people and spark the truth with them. And I say that to lead to your question about my book. It can be found at www.flippingthescripts.com. That's FLIPPINGTHESCRIPTS.com, flippingthescripts.com. And I yield.
Ashe, thank you for that, Brother Allen. Dr. Jones, I'd like to allow you to close the broadcast, if you don't mind.
Well, don't mind, Queen. You know, as I said, this is most grateful I am all week long. I look forward to Wednesday. You know, it's a ritual. You know, something beyond a routine. You know, I enjoy my time here at Sign of the Times, and you know, I just hope that we continue to build, and our listeners continue to support in whatever way that they're able to support us, and we go ahead and we continue to make this thing grow and grow. And I yield with that, Queen. And I thank you for your graciousness of always having me on here. I appreciate it.
Ashe, we appreciate you too. Thank you to Brother Eugene as well for chiming in tonight. Thank you to all the listeners for hanging out and sharing your energy with us, whether you chose to push one or not. Thank you, Brother Allen, for sharing with us and being a part of tonight's conversation. I'm going to go ahead and close it out with a little bit of what I played last night from Brother A$AP Brown, Imam Alameen, and it speaks at the beginning of our interpretation of vanguard revolutionaryism. So we love you, we thank you, and we'll see everybody tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and then Friday night with Brother G2 joining us, speaking on, again, vanguard revolutionaryism and where we are as a society. So we'll see everybody tomorrow night at 6. I love y'all. I'll talk to you soon.
I love you too. Peace.
All right.
See, unlike America would have us believe, the greatest problem confronting this country today is not pollution and bad breath. It's black people. It's black people. See, that's just one of the big lies that America tells you and that you go for because you chumps. You go for it. One of the lies that we tell ourselves is that we are making progress. But here his chair is empty. We're not making progress. We tend to equate progress with concessions. We can no longer make that mistake. You see, when they gave us that nigger astronaut, you say we were making progress, but I told you they were going to lose him in space. He didn't get that far. You put Adam Powell in office and you couldn't keep him. What you think they're going to do with Thurgood Marshall when they get tired of him? They gave you Walter Washington of Washington, D.C., and you said we were making progress. That's not progress. See, it's no in-between. You're either free or you're a slave. There's no such thing as second-class citizenship. But a lot of you running around talking about you Democrats, and the Democrats got you in the biggest trick going. They tell you it ain't our fault. It's the Dixocrats. No such thing as the Dixocrats. The only difference between George Wallace and Lyndon Johnson is one of them's wife got cancer. That's the only difference. You go for it because you chumps. You go for it. The only thing that's going to free Huey is gunpowder. Black powder. That's no victory, that's a concession. When black people become serious about the revolutionary struggle that they are caught up in, whether they recognize it or not, when they begin to go down and knock off people who are oppressing them and begin to render these people impotent, that's when the revolutionary struggle unfolds. Not until.
We have to recognize who our major enemy is. The major enemy is not your brother, flesh of your flesh, and blood of your blood. The major enemy is the honky and his institutions of racism. That's the major enemy. That is the major enemy. And whenever anybody prepares for revolutionary warfare, you concentrate on the major enemy. We're not strong enough to fight each other and also fight him. We will not fight each other today. We will not fight each other. There will be no fights in the black community among black people. There will just be people who will be off. There will be no fights. There will be no destruction. We are going to be united.